You guys all have your Bibles, right? Open up to Ruth chapter 2. This is our second lesson out of Ruth. And just like I've been doing with Sundays, I like this to be a bit more casual, just reading around the circle, going through the story. Like, God wrote stories. And there's something to be said about just enjoying the stories that are in the Bible, but also still learning from them. So there's a lot of context that we kind of have to talk about this week. But just to revamp your memory from last time, who can remind me what roughly happened last time we met? With Ruth chapter 1, what did we learn? Who can tell me some of the main characters?
Naomi.
Yeah, Naomi is the main character, right? We're following Naomi's story. What happened to Naomi?
Her sons and her husband died.
Her sons and her husband died. That's right. And where were they when that happened?
Moab.
They were in Moab. They were not in Israel. And so we see that Naomi's starting in a pretty low place. But then what happens after that? That seems to be like things might be looking up. Or not even necessarily seems like things might be looking up, but what good thing happens to Naomi in that circumstance?
Ruth comes to
it. Oh, that is last week's handout.
Do you guys have Ruth 1 on the page?
Yeah, do you have Ruth 1 or Ruth 2? What are the questions?
Who are the characters?
Wait, let me see. Oh, what happened is, so when I make handouts, I copy-paste the old handout and I reuse the format. So I just forgot to change the title. But these are the right questions.
So they're good? Okay.
Yeah, these are they're good. All right, so getting the housekeeping out of the way. Whoops-a-daisy. But yeah, so what happens to Naomi that seems like things might be looking up? What are some good things?
Ruth stays with her.
Which is kind of the thing. And Naomi doesn't realize at the beginning how big of an advantage that really is. But now, we're getting into Ruth chapter 2. And real quick, when you guys think of Ruth, what do you typically associate with the story of Ruth? What kind of story is it? Before we even talked about last week, if I just said we were talking about the book of Ruth, what might you have thought? This might actually be your first exposure to the book of Ruth. Here, Drew and Taylor, what is the book of Ruth typically thought of as?
The book where we learn about Ruth.
That is partially true, but it's like, what kind of story is it? It's a story about
love.
There we go. Yeah. It's a romance story. It's a little short little romance where Ruth gets hitched, man. And it's like the rom-com of the Bible. And that's kind of typically the headspace that it occupies in people's minds. And Ruth chapter 2 is where we actually start getting into that portion of the story. And so you'll notice we're going through Genesis 1 through 3 on Wednesdays. Why are we doing that? It's a precursor to our dating series. What are we about to do next month? Our dating series. And it is not an accident that I chose to do Ruth on the Sundays while we were going through that. So while we are still going to be looking at kind of the main story, and I'm going to talk to you guys about the kind of the context this takes place in, and we're just going to read and enjoy the story, I'm going to make some comments about dating because that's where we're at. And it was not an accident to pick Ruth while we did that. But first things first. What do I have written on the board?
Words, the whole part.
They are words, yeah. So like these, like, you know, what? Where did you first see these?
The first part.
Yeah, and the first part of Ruth. Because Ruth is taking place in what time period in Israel's history?
Judges.
The Judges, which is a time period where Israel's going well or going poorly?
They come up and down, but they're going poorly.
Yeah, it's kind of up and down, but it's a downward spiral. And so it's like, it's got highs, it's got lows, but overall you're trending to the dirt. So, you know, it's a period in Israel's history where there's a lot of judgment going on, a lot of suffering and difficulty. So Ruth is an example of faithful individuals in wicked nations, and it's also an example of God taking care of faithful individuals while he's judging the nations they're in. So it's kind of an important thing where sometimes we think about, you know, stories and events all the way up, but it's also valuable to think about the way that God cares about individual people. She was. Deborah was one of the judges. Yeah. Yeah, you had Deborah, Ehud, Samson, Gideon, you know, Jephthah. We could go on. Yeah.
I forgot the guy because...
Balak.
No, the guy that didn't want to go to war.
Yeah, Balak.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone forgets his name because he was a pansy. Which is not my words. That's how Deborah describes him. Not in those exact words. That's a bit of a modern way to say it, but he basically gets judged for not willing to go without Deborah, and Deborah's like, "You're an idiot," and then continues on. Anyways, that's our side note for the day. Okay, so that's a whole lot of front loading. That's like 5 minutes of getting us back to where we were, and now we're about to go into Ruth chapter 2. So let's just do what we've been doing. Or actually, I lied, because I need to address things individually with these verses. Okay, follow along. We're about to read a story. So Ruth chapter 2, verse 1. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And we have to stop. So the thing about Ruth is that who's the book of Ruth written to? This is in the Old Testament, right? Who's the people of God in the Old Testament?
The Israelites.
Israelites, right? Yeah, Jews. And Israelites and the Jews, what was like the book that all of them were trained and taught the entire time they grew up? The Bible. They were taught the Torah, they were taught the Old Testament, they read the prophets, but mainly the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch. So there's context that they have that we, as modern day English speakers, a lot of times don't have, even though we should. So that verse right there should be bringing something to your mind, but the issue is it's possible that you don't actually know what it is. So I need someone to go to Deuteronomy chapter 25. Who wants to go? I'm going to make you read a section. Perfect. Deuteronomy chapter 25, and you're going to read verses 5 through 10. And I want everyone to be listening to this because this is very important.
Laws concerning levirate marriage.
Loud and proud.
Levirate. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. And if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, "My husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me." Then the elders of the city shall call him and speak to him, and if he persists, saying, "I do not wish to take her," then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, and pull his sandal off his foot, and spit in his face, and she shall answer and say, "So shall it be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house, and the name of his house shall be called in Israel, the house of him who had his sandal pulled off."
Yep. So that's a lot. That's kind of written in Old Testament language. Who can tell me what roughly that's saying?
If somebody's brother dies, then they have to find somebody else. I don't know.
You're very close.
You have to marry the brother's wife if your brother dies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like if me and Jackson, which this is, no one wants to be a part of this example, but let's just say that me and Jackson are, you know, brothers, because we are, and then I get married, and as I'm married, like maybe we're married for 6 months, and then I die, and I haven't had any kids. If I'm a landowner, then who is my land supposed to go to? Typically, historically, who's the land supposed to go to?
A dude.
The firstborn son. Yeah, right? You're supposed to have an heir. And so if I die, but I don't have any kids, where does my land go?
Your brother?
Yeah, it's kind of up in the air. Typically, it'd be your brother. But the issue is this. When God gave people land, he intentionally gave different people different pieces of land. And one of the things that you have an issue of is like, if I die and then my brother gets all my land, now my brother has like twice the land that he might have otherwise had. And then what happens if like, that keeps happening, and now there's five people in Israel that own all the land. Yeah, it's like kind of run into an issue. So God had a system where if me and Jackson are related to each other and I die, then my brother would have to marry my widowed wife, and then the firstborn son that they had would be legally considered my son, not his. And so my land would go to him. So this doesn't just apply to brothers. When you have the Old Testament law written, it's not written in our like the way that we write laws, where every individual case, it's like, you know, if the person has a blue car, you got to do this. And then if the car is red, you got to do this. And if it's worth this amount, like we are hyper specific in modern day laws. In the Old Testament, that's not how it worked. They wrote laws to give you a general sense of what is and is not just. And then judges would like make the decision. So let's say that I don't have a brother. Well, in that case, maybe I have a cousin. And then he would do the same thing. And so it's kind of like one of those things where the point is perpetuating the name. this is a law that when you're looking at the story of Ruth, real quick, what is Ruth?
A human.
She's a human. That's correct. Her husband is dead, which makes her a? A widow. Does she have any kids?
No.
No, she does not. She also doesn't have anyone to provide for her. So when you read a verse and it says, now Naomi had a relative of her husband, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz, this should be setting off bells in your head. You should be thinking, ring-a-ding-ding, this guy can marry Ruth. This guy can marry Ruth, provide for her, provide for Naomi, and potentially give her kids. Like that, this law should be popping into your head. That is intentionally placed there. But the issue is, we're not Jews. So we don't necessarily know this law, even though we really should. That's why I'm teaching you this law. But we don't necessarily know this, so that doesn't pop into our head, but it needs to. Continuing on. In verse 2, and Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. Okay, we have to stop again. Darn. So who wants to go to Leviticus chapter 19? Someone other than Alex. It's going to be a much shorter section.
Oh, Adelaide, your rain fell off again.
So did it actually?
God.
Oh, LOL. Yeah, man. All right, go to Leviticus chapter 19. I want you to read verses 9 and 10. And I'm going to draw a picture.
Chapter 19, 9 through 10?
Yep, chapter 19, verses 9 through 10.
When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your fields right up to its edge, neither shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest. And you shall not strip your vineyard bare, neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner, for I am the Lord your God.
Now, does this ring any bells for any of you guys? Have we talked about these exact verses before? Maybe when we were going through the book of Nehemiah, and we talked about the book of Leviticus. So I don't know if you guys remember these verses, but this is the law of the gleanings. And I'm just going to draw out roughly what just happened in that. But if you have a field, and your field is like that, what this law is essentially saying is that you're not allowed to glean, you're not allowed to collect any grain from these sections of the field. You can't gather grain from the corners, you can't gather grain from the edges. Why?
So the poor can have it.
So, for example, if the poor want food, what are they going to have to do?
Go to the fields and get grains.
They're going to have to go to the field and get grain. So this is kind of like the Old Testament version of welfare, where they don't just hand you free stuff. You have to go work for it, and it's also dependent on the charity of the people. It's not like a government program. But this is the law. And so this is another thing that you have to be aware of if you're going to understand this story, because otherwise it's like, why? Like, am I allowed to just go to some farmer's field and start, like, gathering food out of it? Like, no. That would be theft in modern United States, because that's not my land, that's not my food. So you might be reading this thing, and what in the world is Ruth doing? Well, she's a widow, and this is how the Old Testament provided for her. But something else that you see. Does it say exactly how far from the corner of the field you have to leave? Does it say exactly how far from the edge of the field you have to leave? No. Also, does it prescribe how this is going to be enforced? What's to stop someone from just being like, okay, I'll leave like half a foot from the corner of my field. I'll leave half a foot from the edge of my field, right? What's to stop someone from doing that? What's to stop someone from just gathering the fallen grapes anyway? Nothing. And so when you're looking at the Old Testament law, each individual is supposed to, as a part of their own service to God, be fulfilling this. So when someone's doing this and Ruth is saying, in whose sight I might find favor, again, is Israel righteous or unrighteous in this time of history?
Unrighteous.
Unrighteous. How many people do you think are following this law?
Not many.
So this is another kind of one of those big things. It's like Ruth is going out. She's trying to find food. Who knows if she'll actually find it? But also, you can learn a lot about someone's character by whether or not they do this from their field and how much of their field they leave unharvested for the sake of the people who are coming. So that's another contextual thing. And that's actually the last little contextual, you know, thing that we have to talk about before we actually get into the story. But let's keep reading. In verse 3, so she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. Now, again, it said she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. We talked about this last time as well. Who can remind me what I said?
Ruth.
about the word, you know, it happened. Do things ever just happen?
No.
No. So who's in control of the random occurrences of life?
God.
God. So this is extremely important. In the book of Ruth, there are no miracles. In the book of Ruth, what you see instead is these little strange happenstances, where even though God is never directly identified as an actor in this story, you can see God all over it. So this is an example where we already know who Boaz is, and then it just so happened that Ruth goes into his portion of the field. And once again, some bells in your head should be going ring-a-ding-ding. So she goes into his field in verse 4, and behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." I'm going to stop again. This is going to get, you know, this is happening a lot in the very beginning, but we're introducing Boaz. And now, this is where the good stuff comes in. I'm about to give you dating advice. Okay, guys. So, have you ever heard of Christianese?
No.
If I say Christianese, I'm sure that you guys have heard that before. Yeah. Vietnamese Christians? That's a funny guess. That's pretty good. So Christianese is like, you know that there are things that Christians just say? Like, you know, if the Lord wills, then I'll get there tomorrow and I'll do this business deal. Jesus loves you. Yeah, God is sovereign. God is in control, man. You know, that's a rough situation, but just know that God is in control. Like, you know, those kinds of like, you know, sweet nothings that Christians throw out because you're like, you're supposed to say it and it makes you sound righteous. So have you ever had people like give you Christianese sayings and you know that they're so fake and it just grates on you? It's like, yeah, okay. But have you ever met people that they talk like that and you can tell it's genuine? Because I've met those people too. So this is one of those things. We're getting introduced to the character of Boaz, and maybe this is Christianese. He's walking up to people and he's saying, "Oh, the Lord be with you." And they're saying, "Oh, the Lord be with you." And like, you know, maybe that's what's going on. But once again, what's the character of Israel at this time?
Unrighteousness.
Unrighteousness. That's exactly right. So the first thing you're seeing with Boaz is like, okay, he's talking like a God lover. Is that genuine?
Probably not.
That's correct. So we're going to be reading a bit more of the story and we're going to see that confirmed. But I'm going to tell you, as a person, as a man, when I'm interacting with people, we talked on Wednesday, what is the thing that you should be looking for when you're, you know, dating someone, trying to get married? What's the most important thing? As I stare at the people, they're Christian. That's a really big one. What's like the pattern of their life that you're trying to look at? What's more important, their appearance or their character?
Their character.
Their character. Yeah, it's exactly correct. So when you're evaluating someone to date them, one of the things that I find is that the difference between someone who, like, they're just speaking Christianese and they're pretending, and someone who actually cares about God, you can tell it in the way that they talk, in the sense that there are some people that they just, like, say things, but also, if you're constantly thinking about something and doing stuff, you talk about it. Like, I have met so many people that can talk my ear off for hours about Fortnite because they just play Fortnite all the time. That's just where their mind is. And when you're interacting with someone and they talk about God and you can tell it's genuine, where they're just looking at a situation, they're like, you know, it was really, really difficult, but then I was just thinking about, you know, God's growing me in this and I want to figure out what he has for me. And like people like that, where it's a natural part of their speech, where they just are talking about God. What does that tell you about them?
That they love Jesus.
Tells you that they love Jesus. It tells you that they're constantly thinking about God, because you talk about the things that you're constantly thinking about. Like, I remember one person that a while back, I'm not going to say her name, but we used to work together, and then for a time, she was, like, looking for a church, and so she came to my church, we would hang out, all that good stuff, and one of the things that really stood out about her was that she talked about God and she talked about Jesus all the time, and it was completely genuine. And what that tells me is that's a person that's consistently praying, that's a person that's in the Bible, that's a person that thinks about God and cares about God. And it's a very quick diagnostic thing to be like, okay, in the course of 5 conversations, how much do you naturally talk about God if I don't prompt you? That was an extremely attractive thing, and I actually tried to date that person. Like, just so you know, when you're looking at quick little things that you can look at about someone, look at what they talk about. Look at how they talk. Figure out, what do they think about? What do they spend their time doing? If there's someone who is constantly talking about God because they're constantly thinking about God,
That's a really attractive thing. Because even if there's some other problems in their character, like maybe they're not super theologically talented, maybe they haven't been in the church that long, maybe they went to kind of, you know, crappy churches, but you can see that they have a genuine heart for God. If someone has a genuine heart for God, even if they're immature, what you know is that they're going to grow. And if I can have someone who knows all of the theological terms, who can speak fluent Christianese, and yet who I see has no real heart for God, if I have a choice between that person or the person who's been living their entire life outside of the church, they converted 5 days ago, and they are brand new to Christianity, they don't know any of the words, but I can tell that they have a heart for God, I'll take the immature Christian 10 times out of 10. Because in 5 years, that person will have matured and grown, and I can know that they actually care about doing what God wants for them, whereas this person is just an arrogant, you know, jerk in a lot of cases.
What's your point to me,
Charlie?
You
pointed at me.
Yeah, I pointed at Taylor.
Wow.
some youth leader drama. You guys are seeing behind the curtain. Anyways, but watch how people talk. Like, in terms of just quick little dating tips, watch how people talk, man. See what they talk about. See what they think about. It tells you about them. So, we see that Boaz speaks Jewese. I don't know, the Jewish version of Christianese. We see that he speaks Israelese. Jewishese. And then if we continue in verse 5, then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, "She is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers.' So she came, and she has continued from the early morning until now, except for a short rest." What did we just learn about Ruth?
She's hardworking.
She's hardworking. Something kind of fun. In the Old Testament, like in the Hebrew Bible, the book of Ruth is placed immediately after the book of Proverbs. Have you guys ever heard of Proverbs 31? So can anyone tell me what Proverbs 31 is? I bet Adelaide knows.
I don't.
You don't? Okay. In that case, I need to tell you what it is for context. Proverbs 31 is the description of the excellent wife, where Solomon is writing to his sons or whatever. Yeah. So, like, you know, the I actually don't even know if it's Solomon in Proverbs 31. But in Proverbs 31, this person is writing to his son, and he's just like, yo, this is the description of the excellent wife. You know, the excellent wife who can find. Her worth is far above diamonds. And it's just going on. It's talking about, you know, her hand grasps the spindle, and she considers a field and buys it, and she makes clothes for all of her people. And it's just a description of the Proverbs 31 woman, which is like the ideal wife, is literally what it is. It's Proverbs 31, 10 through 31. So the book of Ruth is placed immediately after that in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible, because Ruth is considered in, like, Hebrew culture to be the Proverbs 31 woman. So one of the things you see, she is extremely hardworking. Farming is hard, man. Farming is really hard.
Have you ever tried it?
I've done yard work and stuff. Like, so I've dug ditches. I've changed sprinklers. There was a time when I, like, made money by, you know, landscaping people's lawn, trimming their hedges, mowing their lawns, changing their sprinklers, weeding, all of it. And, like, farming is harder than that, and that was hard.
I like the animal part of farming.
The animal part of farming is my least favorite part of farming.
Why?
Animals are a nightmare, man.
Yeah.
Not even chickens.
Smells very bad.
Chickens are also a nightmare. It also smells bad, yeah. Anyways, but all that to say, Ruth is a very hard worker. She's working with her hands, man. Like, this is tiring. And he's like, yeah, she's been working all day except for a short rest. But also, Boaz is noticing Ruth, and you've already got, you know, the levirate marriage in your mind, and you're thinking, check her out, man. And you're, like, rooting for, like, you're already got the Boaz-Ruth ship going on. You're like, oh, he noticed her, guys. So he's asking about her, but we've learned about Boaz. Ruth. Roaz. I like that one, man. So we've already learned about Boaz. It's like, okay, maybe this is a guy of character. And in verse 2, it says he's a worthy man. So we already know that Boaz is a man of character. We see that Ruth is a hard worker, and you learn of her that she left her people to take care of her mother-in-law. So we're learning about Ruth's character. So what should you be looking for? Like, here's pro tip number 2 for the guys in here. What's a really good quality in a woman?
Hardworking.
Hardworking. industrious women should be an attractive thing. I've met guys that are not willing to date women that are, like, more professionally talented slash successful than they are. That's a dumb thing. That should be an attractive quality. And if you can't handle being, like, married to slash dating a girl that's more skilled at you at XYZ, that's a problem with you, not with her. Like, that should actually be a genuinely attractive thing to you. If your wife is smarter than you, baller. If your wife is more hardworking than you, baller. If your wife is, like, wiser than you, baller. Like, straight up amazing. Be attracted to industriously talented women. Anyways, moving on.
I don't
want to look
at me.
She's looking at me.
Oh, gosh. To be fair, Drew was the first one who looked at me.
Oh, my goodness. Anyways, verse 8. And then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." So what we notice here, first of all, another reminder, is Israel righteous or unrighteous at this time?
Unrighteous.
And are widows vulnerable?
Yeah.
Yes. There's not, you know, this is not heavily policed, you know, college campus, or I guess college campuses are a bad example because they, yeah, no, never mind. Not college campuses. This is not a heavily policed, like, civilized urban area. Yeah, right? This is just out in the fields, man, where people can do things and no one would have any accountability. Like, you, yay. There are verses, there are laws in Deuteronomy that talk about how, do I want to talk about this today? No, I don't. Never mind. Okay. We're going to leave that one for another time.
There we go.
Yep. So Boaz is saying, hey, man, I have given my people instruction not to touch you. And he's saying, you're going to drink from the water that they've drawn. So at this point, Boaz is going way beyond the required generosity from Leviticus 19. But then he continues to go beyond. Verse 10, then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner?" Once again, prejudice. Israel has a racism problem. She's a Moabitess, and the Israelites do not like Moabites. Moving on. But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me."
Is this like some small town? Because everyone knows everyone here.
Yes, and we actually talked about in Ruth chapter 1 how Naomi came back after 10 years of sojourning in Moab, and everyone's like, is this not Naomi, the wife of Elimelech? Yeah, so this is like small town vibes, 100%. It's a farm town. But also think about this, Boaz, right? Boaz is Boaz was clearly asking questions. The ship bells should be going off a little bit. All right, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." So, something else that's valuable. Here's dating tip number 3. For the ladies, since I did one for the guys. For the ladies. One of the responsibilities of a man is to be the provider. Which, especially in our culture where it's easier for women to make a wage, which was not always the case historically. Like, in our culture, sometimes the man being the provider means making the decision, like, yeah, you make more money than I do, so you'll be the one who works and I'll be the one that stays at home. Like, that's not out of the picture. But still, if the family is not provided for, the person whose responsibility that is the man. So one of the things to look at is this guy able to take care of me? If a guy is not able to financially take care of you, that's a completely acceptable reason to not date them. That doesn't make you a gold digger. That's actually his job. Like, literally, that's a completely fine thing. Especially when we get to the end of Ruth, like 10 out of 10. That's a completely fine thing. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, one of the things that it talks about is it talks about the provision of widows. And it says that if a man does not provide for the members of, it says if someone does not provide for the members of his own family, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So heavy, heavy language there. And also for the guys, be able to provide. Yeah, which, and that doesn't necessarily mean, like, it's not to say that every man is responsible to provide, like, extraordinary amounts of excess, but you should be providing enough.
But what about what you said earlier? Mm-hmm. She's, like, smarter and, like, just better than things at you.
Yeah.
What if she's providing for you then?
Mm-hmm. Which is fine. And that doesn't give you an excuse to be lazy, for example.
Yeah.
Like, if you're both working, awesome. But then if when you have kids, you make the decision that the guy's going to be stay at home because the woman has more earning potential, that's fine. But also, that's not an excuse for the guy to be lackadaisical. However, the normal pattern is that you have the guy out in the workplace and you have the woman who's primarily responsible for the stuff at home. And that's something that is espoused in Proverbs 31, Genesis chapter 2. It's espoused in the New Testament in 1 Timothy or 2 Timothy chapter 2? We talked about it last night, or on Wednesday. So the typical pattern is that you have the man working, you have the woman who's primarily responsible for the things at home. But there are circumstances where a couple can decide to do something different. So yeah, 100%. This isn't necessarily meant to be legalist, like legalistic kind of thing. But normal pattern. And even in that situation, if the wife is the one working and the husband's the one staying at home, who's the leader? Based on what we learned on Wednesday. Anyone who was there? Who's the leader?
God.
God is the leader. In a marriage, who's the leader? God. Still God, sure. Okay. Between the man and the woman, who is the managing partner? The dude.
There we go.
That's right. So there is still that role. That was a conversation that I had with people in youth group when I was in youth group, is I was talking to a girl named Haley, and she was like, you know, if I make more money than the man, then why should I still have to submit to him? And I was like, the issue of submission is not related to who makes more money. It's related to the roles that God has given you. Like, there's nothing wrong with a woman making more money than a man, but that doesn't change the relationship. All for free. Anyways, so...
All for free.
All for free. That was nothing that I was planning to talk about today. Extra credit, yeah. That's outside of my preparation. But anyways, the things that we've learned today. If you're a dude or a girl looking at someone, think about the way they talk. Do they think about God? Do they care about God? Do they have a heart for God? If you're a guy looking at a girl, industrious women... baller. Okay, if you're a girl looking at a guy, can he not provide for you? Is he a deadbeat loser with no job? Don't date him. And let's continue.
I have a job. What the heck?
Are you guys like looking at?
They're both looking at it from each time.
Dude, chill, guys. I literally have a job. These guys.
Oh my gosh.
For the record, Drew is amazing.
Some lazy.
I'm like trying to read the Book of Ruth and just a bunch of shit just being thrown.
Big attack.
Holy cow.
Gosh.
That was
good. I have a job, guys.
I'm gonna bust a gut, man. Holy cow. And you're in school, right?
No.
Oh, not anymore. Okay, never mind. Anyways. Okay, where were we? Alright, verse 14. And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed out to her roasted grain, and she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. Again, this is so far beyond the Leviticus 19, 9 through 10 required amounts of generosity. He's pulling water for her. He's letting her eat with all of the reapers. He's like all of this is so far beyond what he's required to do. Generosity, fantastic character trait. Now then, roasted grain. I mean, whenever I hear that, I imagine things like raisin cakes or bread, like a pancake. I don't know. Which I'm not saying necessarily. Like, I'm not saying that's what it was, but I just imagine it's just a baked bread item.
Yeah.
Is really what it comes down to.
Doesn't matter if it was.
Yeah. Not crucial for the story.
Yeah.
Verse 15. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young man, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves," which means even the stuff you've already harvested, if she walks over to the stuff you've already harvested and bound out, let her take from it. I'm going to stop commenting on the generosity, but this is hardcore over the top. And also pull out some from the bundles for her and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her.
He really likes her.
He's being extremely generous. Ring-a-ding-ding! Anyways, so she gleaned in the field until evening, and then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. Which also, there is nothing in the story at this point to indicate that that Boaz is, like, romantically interested in Ruth. At this point of the story, all of this is strictly a commentary on his character. Which, that's kind of clarified in chapter 3, which is why I'm telling you right now. But at this point, you see that Ruth is potentially, and also Ruth is not looking at Boaz in anything. There's nothing to indicate that Ruth is looking at Boaz romantically. All of this is stuff that we're looking at because we're in rom-com mode, based on chapter 2, verse 1. All right, verse 17. So she gleaned in the field until evening. Once again, Ruth is a hard worker. Holy cow. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley, which I looked up how much an ephah of barley is, and different sources gave me different amounts, and I didn't take the time to actually, like, find the correct answer. Some people say it was 10 days worth of food. Other people say that it was about 47 pounds of wheat.
Mine says, in the NLT version, it says it filled an entire basket.
Yeah.
So it's a decent amount. Yeah.
Yeah. So even if we don't know the exact amount, like, the big point is it's a lot. It's a whole lot of food. And she...
bushel, that's what mine says.
You says bushel?
3/5 of a bushel.
3/5 of a bushel. Yeah. Yeah, which all of those are, in those translations, that's going to be an estimation of what an ephah is. Ephah is the...
It might say in the back of the Bible, too. I was messing around seeing with the measurements.
Yep.
It said a bunch of things.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. So I think that an ephah is like 10 omers, and then an omer is like a day's amount of food. I don't know. It's a thing.
20 quarts or 22 liters?
Why don't they just use American?
Yeah, mine says 22.
Why don't they just use the imperial system? Like, eh. And she took it up and went to the city. Her mother-in-law, Naomi, saw what she had gleaned, and she also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today, and where have you worked?" Like, she's noticing how much Ruth is bringing home, and she's like, dang, someone was nice to you. And her mother-in-law, blessed is the man who took notice of you. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I worked today is Boaz." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "This man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." Ring-a-ding-ding! So this is the exact moment where Ruth is like, oh. Because again, Naomi just directly referenced the levirate marriage law that we read earlier. And so Ruth, at this point, is immediately thinking in terms of, okay, this guy might marry me. This guy might be someone who can provide for me. And she has already seen on full display the kind of character he has, and he has already seen on full display the kind of character she has. So, rom-com glasses, hardcore on. This is like when the main character of your rom-com looks at the other main character of the rom-com, and just all of a sudden they put the sparkles around and like the filter, and they do it slow-mo. This is like this is the moment where like the characters look at each other and you're like, they're finally getting it, guys! So that's like, you know, where we're at.
So,
can you tell that I like rom-coms?
No.
What a surprise. Verse 21. And Ruth the Moabite said, "Besides, he said to me, 'You shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest.' And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, 'It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest you be in another field assaulted.'" We commented on that earlier. Vulnerable women. So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvests, and she lived with her mother-in-law. Here's the other thing we're seeing. We had the rom-com bells going off, and nothing happened. She didn't go back the next day and be like, "You're a redeemer!" No. She worked until the end of the harvest. So even though she's aware that this is potentially a thing, nothing's really being done about it. But what do you think Ruth might be doing during that time that she's harvesting? Because she was eating it. Yeah, getting to know him. Because she was eating at his table. She's seeing his young men. She's seeing the way he treats his employees. She's seeing the way that he harvests his field. She's learning about Boaz's character during this time, and it's now actively a part of her awareness that he might be able to marry her, and she's watching him. What is Boaz doing? Even if he's not looking at her with romantic interest, what does he now have a front row seat to see? Her personality, her character. He's going to see her continuing to work throughout the harvest. He's going to be at the table with her, having conversations. So Boaz is going to be learning about her.
You could say they're dating.
Well, I mean, at this point, nothing like that is like really happening. But they're seeing each other and like they're evaluating each other.
Every day at dinner.
Yeah, they're seeing each other regularly. They're bonding over meals. And that's kind of where we leave off. It's like we've had the rom-com bells. We had rom-com like inklings ever since chapter 2, verse 1, where it was like, and he was a close relative and he was a worthy man. And you're already like, oh. But now we're at the point where it's been specifically awakened in Ruth's mind that he might be able to redeem her. And so there's like that little inkling where one of the characters is on it now. And also we're looking at all of this. We're seeing Boaz's character. We're seeing Ruth's character. And now you're supposed to be feeling that kind of like tension in your chest of what's going to happen? Are they going to end up together? Or is this not going to work out? So now we have all of the information that we need to get into chapter 3 and continue learning about this story. But continuing to see, there are faithful people in wicked nations. Boaz is a faithful person. Naomi is a faithful person. Ruth is a faithful person. And God is faithful to individuals in the context of the nations he's judging. And then we talk about context with things like levirate marriage and whatnot. Anyways, let's bow our eyes, pray it out.
Bow our eyes,
close our mouths, and fold our ears.
Oh, fold the dishes.
Fold the dishes, perfect.
And water my neighbor's
goldfish. Clip your turtle's toenails. Ooh. Anyways, let's bow our heads. Lord, thank you that you write stories. Thank you that you don't just give us information only in the context of instructions, that the entire Bible isn't just a list of rules and laws, but that you take principles and you put them into interesting and fun stories. Like, Ruth is so fun to read. And thank you that you make it fun. I pray that you would help us to learn about what we can look at in our own lives in terms of dating and marriage, but also, this is a story about you. This is a story about the way that you saw one widow in the land of Moab and in the land of Israel, even in the context of judging the nations around them. Like, Lord, ultimately, the main character in this story is you. And I pray that we would learn about the kind of God you are to us and the way that you can take care of us even in the midst of hard times, and that, Lord, you see us, not as parts of a group, but even as individuals. Lord, help us to leave this with wisdom in how we go about our relationships, but also help us to leave this with a greater love and admiration for you. And I pray these things in the name of our King Jesus Christ. Amen.